Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher and our first installment of Wellness Wednesday, our new regular feature on health, on everything from vitamins to healthcare to exercise and diet, research and medical technology. Joining us now to talk about one of the most basic health challenges of our age, that is salt consumption, is Dr. Martha Gulati. She's Director of Preventive Cardiology and Women's Cardiovascular Health at The Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
There are studies that question whether salt consumption is the problem that the American Heart Association, the American Medical Association, and many others say that it is. Where's the confusion?
Well, the confusion is that there hasn't been good randomized trials, and that, I think, is why there's controversy. There's been studies in the last year, I think it was in 2011, two studies came out, and that followed up with a lot of debate in the community. But the one study that was released was a European study, and it said that people who had the lowest salt consumption actually had higher cardiovascular mortality. And they ended their paper concluding that low-salt diets should not be advocated, despite what we know about low-salt diets in people, particularly in people who have hypertension. So it created so much controversy that a different journal that didn't even publish the article felt that they had to write an editorial to comment, don't make changes based on this one study. There was many limitations in the study, including that the fact that they measured low sodium consumption by urine sodium excretion, and it was the people with the lowest sodium who had the lowest urine volume, which makes you suspect that they didn't even collect all their urine. So, you know, I think that got people up in arms, but the reality is we have enough data right now that having a low sodium diet does lower blood pressure. And for people who are hypertensive or people with what we call pre-hypertension, nearing hypertension but not needing medical treatment yet, we can actually lower their blood pressure by helping them lower the salt in their diet. And it's one of many things that you can do to improve blood pressure.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Dr. Martha Gulati. She's Director of Preventive Cardiology and Women's Cardiovascular Health at The Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. We're talking about salt right now and salt consumption. If you have a question or comment for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. When we talk about salt intake and the American Heart Association's recommendation that people with high blood pressure or who are at risk for hypertension should eat less than 1,500 milligrams of sodium a day, we're only talking about roughly a half teaspoon of salt. And that seems like incredibly little to make that much of a difference.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing how much salt we actually consume. The average American is something like 3,500 milligrams of sodium is what we consume daily. For most people, actually more than 50%, we say that your recommendation, less than 1,500 milligrams, is the amount you should get. And that's for anyone over the age of 50, African Americans, people with diabetes, people with chronic kidney disease, and people with hypertension. So that's quite a bit of our population. And most of us eat more. And the reason that we eat more salt is more of our food is containing salt. I think it's also we talk in terms of sodium, not salt, and that sometimes can be confusing to
people. The semantics.
Yeah, because sodium doesn't equal salt, actually. Salt is sodium chloride, so it's about 40% sodium and 60% chloride. And I think it's confusing. Sometimes we talk in how many tablespoons of salt. Like you said, that's the recommendation of 1,500 milligrams is about half a tablespoon of salt. But we don't always get to add that into our food. It's not like we're counting it out. Almost every food we eat has some sodium. Even natural foods have sodium in them. So it's a question of being aware of what are the worst culprits. I mean, things, you know, the American Heart Association released its Salty Six in the last year. And its Salty Six was like just making people aware of certain foods that are very high in salt. Bread is their first one. Bread has a lot of salt, and particularly it might be written as a label as one slice, and you might have two slices, and then you add in other things into your bread, so you increase your sodium content. Cold cuts is another one, cured meats. The third one is pizza. The fourth one is poultry. And poultry, you have to be very careful about just when you buy it. When it looks plump and healthy, often what they've done to chicken and pork is they inject sodium chloride to make it look better. It also adds the weight to what you're buying. And that's a hidden source of sodium, I think, to most people. So, I mean, the other things are soup. Soup can be incredibly high in sodium, and sandwiches. And it's not sandwiches, it's partly because of what you put in the sandwich. It's the bread, it's the condiments. So you have to be very careful. And any sandwich, including, you know, hamburgers, like that kind of sandwich too, can be very high in salt.
What should a healthy adult or child shoot for?
Well, I think we should all be just looking at our sodium intake and trying to reduce it. And I do think that we do have more control than we realize. We've become a bit of a fast food nation. We eat a lot more processed food. We eat things that we didn't make. And that ultimately, that means we have no control over sodium. But when what we have to do is just make smarter choices, buying the low salt options or the no salt options, asking at restaurants when we eat out to not add salt to our food, even creams, any cream that they're going to put on in a restaurant, even if you asked for no added salt, there's salt in their sauces and creams. So you might ask for half the sauce being placed on that. Maybe even when you eat a sandwich out, cutting it in half and eating only half of it and making the rest of your meal vegetables. Vegetables and fruit are, in fact, such great sources of potassium. And potassium actually counters the effect of sodium. Oh. So one of the things that I think people don't even recognize is that we have a very high need for potassium, but most of us don't get it because we don't eat enough fruits and vegetables. So, again, this is a lot about us educating everyone, but also making people make smart food choices themselves, reading labels, also looking at portions, because it's all well and good that there's something that has low salt, like ketchup. You would say 167 milligrams of sodium in one tablespoon of ketchup. But the question is, do you use one tablespoon or did you just squeeze it on indiscriminately and then not really know how much you've used? And ultimately adding to your total salt intake.
French fry lovers of the world, beware.
Yeah.
In other words, it's just not the salt on the French fries.
Yeah, and it's another thing that's actually surprising to me is that when sometimes you try to make the better food choice, so say you say, I'm going to have the baked chips instead of the regular chips, probably most people won't know that that actually has higher salt content than the fried chips. So, I mean, it's, you know, when you buy it in a bag.
It doesn't have the trans fats that the fried chips might.
Exactly.
But.
And it might even be lower calorie, but it's going
to
have higher
sodium. But to
flavor
it up, they've maybe.
Exactly. Flavor is what people are making, relying on salt.
Is salt flavor addicting? Because I've seen, I want to get to your salt shaker program at the medical center, but I want to talk about the salt shaker itself, because when you see people dumping salt on their food, and I've seen them, young and old alike, it has to be a taught behavior. And I wonder, do you really need that much salt on there? Is it tasting that much differently to you than it is to me?
Well, for me, the most ironic thing is when I make something and if somebody adds salt without tasting it, like, give it a chance, make sure that you even need the salt. And I think for a lot of people, it's just trained habit. You see a salt shaker, you have your food, you dump salt on your food, and that's the way that you choose to eat. And I do think it is somewhat addictive. I also think that it can be a, you know, first it's a learned behavior, but it's also a learned behavior to reduce your salt. Because if you yourself reduce the amount of salt in your diet, even by a small amount, you will start going out to restaurants or eating other people's food and being like, that's too salty, I can't eat it. And I think that it's just that we are so used to everything having salt in our diet that we don't know the difference anymore.
So I mentioned the salt shaker program. It's a fixture in most restaurants and many home dining rooms. You've led a movement to remove them from the tables at the Wexner Medical Center. Tell us about that.
Well, it was, you know, a simple thought to why not display that we are being healthy so that we can teach our patients and their families when they're visiting the hospital what we think would be a better way to live. So simply by removing the salt shakers in our hospital cafeteria, we have, one, reduced the amount of stuff on people's table, but also made people actually taste their food because they will have to get up and walk up to the other part of the cafeteria if they want salt. We aren't denying them salt. We're just saying, do you really need it? And I think think that's actually really changed. It's really made people think about the salt consumption. We put out little signs of education when we first did it, and there's been no complaints, and it's actually expanding across the OSU campus beyond the medical center, that we're going to be gradually phasing this in, that the salt shakers, even in the cafeterias in the dorms on campus, are not going to be a standard setting.
I was interested in a recommendation in an article that included you as a source to wash canned or frozen vegetables. There's a lot of salt added to those, and it was kind of an interesting idea.
Yeah, I mean, you have to be really smart. I mean, it's great to buy, and it's, you know, it's cheaper, to be honest with you, to buy canned vegetables, but you do have to rinse them with salt. You have to rinse them to get the salt off of them, and that will actually reduce the salt by about half. So frozen vegetables, you can buy no salt frozen vegetables. You just have to be smart and read it and read that they didn't add salt to your vegetables.
Yeah, we have an email from Gloria. She says, I cannot believe the amount of sodium or salt in frozen food meals. Those pre-boxed meals are full of it. Mm-hmm. I never realized how much until I started looking. But the range really varies. Some boxes have 600 milligrams and some have 1,200 milligrams. Does that depend on the type of food being preserved slash frozen? Or does it make it taste better?
It's a bit of both. It's the food processor's choice to make it. It does help preserve the food. And so that's why they add it. It has a longer shelf life, if you will, in the freezer by adding more salt. And even when people at this time of year, a lot of people are thinking about weight loss and they choose things like the lean cuisines in the frozen section. Well, it's okay if you don't have a blood pressure problem. But if you have a blood pressure issue, you might cause damage just by eating some of their foods because they are high in salt. And you just have to be smart and read the back of them, because that really does affect, you know, I mean, I think it's something, I'm glad she noticed it, because we're always telling people frozen food, it's processed. Actually, a lot of that stuff is processed food, those frozen prepackaged meals. So being very smart about what you're putting into your body always is important.
Yeah, when you refer to us as a fast food nation, you're not just dumping on the McDonald's and the Wendy's and the so forth. Which brings one of our big fast food restaurant chains is using sea salt on their french fries now. And sea salt isn't necessarily better salt. I like to cook with it because it flavors things with less salt, actually.
And that's the key. You can use sea salt and they do have more flavor. So hopefully you use less of them, but they aren't better. Gram per gram, it's the same sodium chloride that you're putting into your food. And you need to remember, if you only cook with sea salt, you're not getting iodine. The only source we have of iodine is in table salt.
I was going to ask you about that too.
Yeah, so table salt is the only thing that gives us naturally iodine. Now, nobody in this country is at risk of having iodine deficiency, okay, given our food sources have so much salt.
Okay, all right. So, and then just real quickly, the School of Public Health at the University of California, Berkeley, recommended that the best way to shop a supermarket was around its perimeter. Mm-hmm. I thought that was an interesting way to approach it.
Yeah, and unless the supermarkets get too smart and change it on us, that is the truth. But I heard that they're listening to that and they want to change it up. But it is true, if you think about most grocery stores, the fruits and vegetables, the dairy, the meats, all sort of are on the outer perimeter, and everything that's processed or canned is sort of in the middle. And so you make better choices if you never go in the middle. And, you know, trying to follow that, even just coming in with a shopping list and not going in that area unless you absolutely need to, can help you make better choices. There's a lot of apps now out too that can really help you. There's something called Calorie Counter. Even if you're not counting calories, though, you can scan in all the food that you're eating or enter it, and it will actually not just put in the calories of the food, but it actually calculates the sodium. So I think it's a great new, and there's many apps out there that will do that for you.
Well, thanks for talking with us today about it. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
Dr. Martha Gulati, she's Director of Preventive Cardiology and Women's Cardiovascular Health at the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. Coming up, we're going to talk about genetics. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station. And your WOSU Public Media member card benefits are now even better with the Member Card Benefit of the Month. Each month, show your member card its elected partners for extra discounts. The member card benefit of the month for January is Pro Musica Chamber Orchestra. Enjoy 2-for-1 admission all month long. Support our station at the $85 level and receive the WOSU member card as your gift. Just visit WOSU.org. And thank you for your support of 89.7 NPR News. It's 19 degrees with partly sunny skies, a high of 26 today. Mostly cloudy tonight and a low of 13. Increasing clouds on Thursday with a high of 31, and there is a slight chance of some snow Thursday night. Still cold, a low of 17 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Nearly a decade ago, the Human Genome Project was completed. The goal is to map the genes that make us human. It would answer questions, predict the future, and usher in a new era of research, this one revolving around the tiniest bits and pieces that define our physical potential. Last month, Dispatch medical reporter Misty Crane produced a series of articles on the topic, including its implications for some Central Ohioans. Misty's with us today to talk about that. Welcome back to the show, Misty Crane.
Thanks, Ann.
So the vice chairwoman of laboratory genetics at Nationwide Children's Hospital told you that genetics could change healthcare if they do it in the right way. What did she mean by that?
I think what she meant is if they apply the knowledge they're gaining about genetic anomalies and how they affect our health in a reasonable way, in a smart way, and in a way that's accessible to a lot of Americans, it's really going to revolutionize healthcare. There are a lot of ethical considerations, though, too. You really can look at more than you need to look at in a given person, and there are questions about how much of that information patients or the parents of children might want to know.
Yeah, you were talking about making it accessible to most Americans, and I think one of the words that popped up in your articles was egalitarian. You know, is it fair if you don't have the right insurance coverage and that sort of thing? How much access do Americans have to their genetic information?
Well, those with deep pockets have as much access as they want. The rest of us, it really depends on our insurance plans and on what we're looking for. If you have a family history of breast cancer and your aunt was tested and we know there's a mutation there, you're probably going to get coverage or at least a reasonable amount of that testing covered. Other things are really up in the air now. Things are coming along faster than insurance companies are responding. So what science can do in terms of finding out the cause of a disease or disorder and what the payers are willing to pay they're not really there.
Do we know about what's going to be required under the new healthcare, the Patient Protection and Affordability Act?
I'm not certain to what degree that speaks to genetics specifically. I do know there's a federal law that protects us from discrimination in certain cases based on what genetic information we know about ourselves. Your employer can't discriminate against you. They can't take your health insurance away because you have a predisposition. But there really is some gray area there, even with privacy protection. So.
You wrote that the whole issue becomes even more complex. First of all, in some cases, you mentioned earlier, you know, too much information might be an issue. Some patients might now want to know all there is to know about their genetic potential, but that might not be as useful as it sounds.
Well, right, because there are studies that look at just select populations and determine that in this population, in this group of Chinese young men, this mutation tends to mean they have a higher risk of heart disease. But you can't really extrapolate that to everybody on the planet. So let's say you pay for a genetic test that broadly looks at a lot of different diseases, and you can do that now. There's direct-to-consumer genetic testing. And so you get all this information back, and some of it may be really useful to you. You may find out that you are a hypermetabolizer of Coumadin. So you know you don't want to take a lot of that. You want to take a smaller dose should you need it.
It means that Coumadin, of course, is a blood thinner, mm-hmm. and it could overthin your blood.
Right, okay. Which is a bad thing, obviously. So, yeah, but the limits there are a lot of different types of limits when it comes to genetic testing, but one of the big ones is a genetic mutation doesn't dictate that that thing is going to happen. It just tells you that maybe you're more predisposed. And some of the research backing that up is stronger than some of the other research. So there are things like the breast cancer mutations where it's, you know, it's pretty much a slam dunk that you have a 80% risk if you have a certain mutation. There are other things that just aren't so solid right now.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dispatch medical reporter Misty Crane. We're talking about a series of articles she's wrote just last month on the topic of genetics, including its implications for some central Ohioans. If you have a question or comment for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. You wrote that the whole issue becomes even more complex when you talk about giving parents all there is to know about their children. Mm-hmm. Why is that the case?
Well, there are diseases that are genetically based that won't happen to us until we're, you know, an adult, maybe 60 years old, or maybe even 70 or 80 years old in the case of Alzheimer's. And should you map the whole genome for a child and give all of that information to the parent, there are ethical considerations there that geneticists and pediatricians are having to sort through right now, because it's really going to be something that's accessible quite soon, and nobody's sure how to deal with that. So if you're looking to see if the child has autism, which is something naturally parents may be looking for an answer on if they're noticing some developmental problems, and it's really affordable to look for a bunch of other things, what is the pediatrician supposed to share with the parent, and what should they keep? I mean, that child will one day be an adult and one who gets to make his or her own decisions about whether they want to know that information.
So. And when they're doing those kinds of tests, when you test for one genetic mutation, you're getting a raft of others as well, right? Automatically or not necessarily?
Not necessarily. It depends on the test. You can look for one specific thing, which is historically, that's what mostly has been happening. You can do a panel of genetic tests when you know that you're looking for something in a certain area and there are certain list of mutations that are most likely. Mm-hmm. Those are happening, too, fairly frequently. The big dilemma is with full genome sequencing, which historically has been astronomic. You know, you're not going to pay for the full genome to be sequenced, but now they're talking about being able to do that for $1,000, which is less in some cases than one of those gene panels. So if it becomes cheaper, why not do the whole thing and have all this information should you perhaps need it one day?
And along with that, the counseling that you might need to understand it?
Correct. Because there are people out there who would want to know that they might have Alzheimer's someday or Parkinson's. But there are others who would rather just wait and see. You know, that's a heavy load, and there's not much in the way of prevention and nothing in the way of treatment.
Kind of like
case.
The gender of your child?
Right. Well,
Odessa from Columbus gave us a quick call, said she has a history of cancer in her family, but doctors won't give her a gene test.
Yeah.
Is there some, I mean, can doctors make that decision?
Well, you're best served by seeing a genetic counselor.
Okay.
And there are cases in which you may think, well, surely there must be some genetic explanation here and something useful for me moving forward. But the genetic counselor's first stop is going to be a full family history. They're going to, before they take any blood, they're going to talk to you about what cancers were in your family and who had them. And it may be that there's been a bunch of different kind of cancer. And remember, cancer is hundreds of diseases, if not more. It's not one disease. Mm-hmm. And if they don't link together in some way that makes sense to run genetic tests, they don't really know what they're looking for. It's, you know, a genetic test might not make sense. But based on my research, I would see a genetic counselor if you really feel that there's something in your family you're worried about.
Experts at Nationwide, you said, are discussing how and when to bring genetic sequencing here. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, are there other hospitals in the area that do it, or other healthcare organizations that do it in the area? And what are those conversations about?
Well, Nationwide really would be the first to offer genetic sequencing to patients in this area. Most people now, if they're having their full genome sequence, it's being sent away somewhere. Ohio State researchers are using it and using it to really help specific patients on a limited basis. They're not doing the sequencing there. They're sending it out. But but it has really changed the course of treatment in some cases. At Children's, I think it's just a matter of figuring out the best way to bring it in, whether and how to make it widely available to the public versus for research and for specific patients already under the care of doctors there.
You wrote that health insurance coverage of testing varies. Mm-hmm. Do we know? Well, I asked you earlier how the patient protection and affordability law will handle that, but do the health insurance companies at this point have a lot of say over whether they're going to cover it or not? Or is it sort of written into the plan, you know, like it covers, you know, annual checkups?
As I understand it, it's really a plan by plan kind of decision. Mm-hmm. And it's to talk to genetic counselors, they would say in the areas where a lot is understood about what you can do if you have the information, you know, whether that be prevention, more frequent screening, that sort of thing, or whether it be maybe treatment, you know, a prophylactic treatment because, you know, you're predisposed to something. They would argue that the insurance companies should come along as fast as possible on the things with solid science behind them, because you're paying a certain amount up front to prevent a lot of costs down the road. I mean, with cancer or with a congenital heart defect or something of that nature, if you can nip it in the bud, you're way better off financially.
You mentioned earlier that it's already against the law to discriminate against somebody because of their genetic background, but that's just for healthcare insurance. That's not necessarily for life insurance going forward, right?
Right. It protects you against employment discrimination and healthcare insurance discrimination. It does not protect you against life insurance discrimination.
And once you have a genetic testing done, let's say you have it mapped entirely, you mm-hmm. spend the money to do it. Do you have to report that if an insurance company asks you if you've had that done, or is that still not something they're asking?
That's not something they're routinely asking at this point, but that's one of the many questions that people are wondering. You know, it is a really important point in history right now with genetic testing, but there are far more questions than answers. You know, we'll just have to wait and see how things come out. If they're not paying for a test, I'm not sure how they require you to disclose the results of a test. If you're doing an independent, direct-to-consumer sort of thing, it's your business. But there are a lot of people who are worried, depending on the direct-to-consumer company, how careful they're going to be going forward with your information.
And then going forward beyond that, could life insurance companies start requiring mm-hmm. you to have genetic testing
sure.
done?
Sure.
And they'll pay for it.
Yeah, they already, you know, they run tests to see if there's tobacco in your blood. If they want to run tests to see if you're going to get Alzheimer's, they theoretically could, unless there's legislation to prevent that.
Just because you have a genetic predisposition to a disease, say colon cancer, it doesn't mean you're going to get it, because there's, as you mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. lots of other factors, environment, lifestyle, and so on. But it's interesting from reading your articles that about 80% of rare disorders are caused by genetics. It's an interesting contrast.
Right, right. But being caused by genetics doesn't necessarily mean even if that person has the mutation that they would get it. That's sort of the thing. I mean, they're looking at the people who have a diagnosed disorder and figuring out that most of that is linked to some sort of genetic mutation.
Versus an environmental factor.
Mm,
yeah.
Right.
When people find out that their children have a genetic disorder, do they usually end up getting everybody tested for it? How does that typically work?
It really depends on the family. I interviewed some members of a family where they know they have a congenital heart problem, and it can cause sudden death in young people, and did recently. An OSU student who was otherwise very healthy, he died of this heart defect. And in that family, many of the people have been tested, but there are others who just don't want to know. And you can understand both sides of it, because with this particular heart defect, you might have the genetic predisposition and you could play sports your whole life and die at 90 on a ski slope of something unrelated. So knowing that your whole life, you have to carry that around with you and decide how to live your life. Should you participate in things that might make your heart run faster?
I was interested in an example that you used in one of your articles, that some of the family members did go ahead and get tested and indeed were found with the genetic disorder, but others didn't get tested, but took the cue and decided to change their lifestyle,
right,
assuming, but didn't want to know.
Yeah, I think that was the family of Tracy Leopold, who has Lynch syndrome. She wanted everybody to know as soon as she was tested. And that is one, and we should be careful to say, when you're tested, it doesn't mean you have the disorder.
Right.
It means you have the predisposition. So there's no guarantee. And there were members of her family who couldn't get in for testing fast enough. And then there are some who, there's one cousin in particular, she said, who went in for early colonoscopies, but still didn't want to know about her genetic predisposition. And you know, she doesn't blame her. She feels differently. She believes that knowing that is powerful.
As far as the testing goes, the commercially available testing, uh-huh, is there a big increase in that now, or more and more people doing it?
It's far more available than it used to be. I did notice right after the series ran, 23andMe, which is the California company that runs the cheapest tests that most people who are getting it go for, they came down to $99 for a panel, a pretty big panel of tests. They're not doing full genome sequencing yet, but you can get a lot of information for $99. As long as you know how to read it and pay attention to the caveats, it could be useful. The people I spoke with who are having that done really feel like they got a lot out of it.
Genetic counselors are pretty specialized, though. It's not, mm-hmm, like you can get one of these cheapo tests done and then book a genetic counselor to sit down with you to go over it. They're very busy.
Right. They are. You could meet one. And there are genetic counselors here at Ohio State who have seen people who've done direct-to-consumer testing, and they get the results back and say, whoa, you know, what's going on? This says that I'm going to have esophageal cancer. And so out of concern that they didn't know what to do with the information, they've gone to see genetic counselors. Most people don't, though, who do the direct-to-consumer testing.
Okay. Well, Misty Crane, thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Thanks.
It's Misty Crane. She's a Dispatch medical reporter. Coming up, we're going to hear from Dr. John Swartzberg from the UC Berkeley Wellness Letter. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
WOSU Public Media is excited to announce a new weekend lineup beginning January 5th. Listen to Radiolab every Saturday at noon and discover a show about curiosity. Saturdays at 2 p.m., it's the Moth Radio Hour, a program dedicated to the art of storytelling. And at 3, it's a show about fascinating ideas, the TED Radio Hour. Listen to Radiolab, The Moth, and TED Saturday afternoons on 89.7 NPR News beginning January 5th.
And this is 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station. Stay right here in 20 minutes at noon. Fresh Air begins. Joining the show, Quentin Tarantino on his new slavery-era spaghetti western revenge film, Django Unchained. Also remembering character actor Harry Carey Jr. That's Fresh Air from noon until 1 on here on 89.7 NPR News. It's 18 degrees in downtown Columbus. Sunshine today, a high near 26. partly cloudy tonight, a low of 13, increasing clouds and a high of 31 on Thursday. Support for 89.7 comes from Ohio State's Wexner Medical Center announcing the opening of Spirit of Women Park, thanks to the generous support of the Ingram family. Located near the Wexner Medical Center, the Spirit of Women Park features thousands of tiles hand-painted by donors to honor special women in their lives. medicalcenter.osu.edu. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to the final segment of our first installment of Wellness Wednesday. Joining us now to talk about some of the latest items in the University of California Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter is the chair of its editorial board, Dr. John Swartzberg. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Swartzberg.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Earlier in the program, we were talking about salt consumption and how easy it is to consume large amounts of sodium unless you're paying attention. And in the wellness letter this month, there's a similar discussion about arsenic and a September Consumer Reports analysis of rice. What's the connection?
Well, the connection with rice and arsenic is potentially disturbing. The Consumer's Report came out with a report, as you mentioned, in September. The government has had several reports. And people are starting to worry about how much arsenic there is in rice. That said, no one really knows how much we should be worried. Maybe just a little bit, maybe a lot.
As far as rice goes, why rice? Why not wheat? Why not corn? What's special about rice that makes it more prone to arsenic?
Well, rice, because of the way it's grown, is grown primarily submerged in water. And water leaches out a lot of the inorganic arsenic that's in the soil. And so the rice is really bathed in this inorganic arsenic, whereas other crops that are grown in the soil will bind to the arsenic and it won't get into the crops as much. So that's what makes rice particularly bad. Now, it's important that your listeners know that there's a little bit of arsenic in, unfortunately, in all the foods we eat. But there just seems to be more in the rice because of the reasons I gave you.
Right. Now, arsenic is naturally occurring as well as an industrial byproduct. How does it occur in nature? And I guess which is more of a threat to us, nature or industry or both?
Right. Yeah. We call it organic arsenic, meaning that's the kind that is just one of the elements on our planet. And that doesn't appear to be as serious a problem as the inorganic arsenic that's been used in pesticides to control other pests for crops. So it's the inorganic that we worry about more. Most of the data we have suggests that some of the problems associated with arsenic, like cancer, nerve damage, et cetera, are probably due to the inorganic arsenic.
So the problem is long-term exposure.
Right. You know, for years and years and years, people have been using arsenic, as I mentioned, as a pesticide, and it's in the soil now. And we're starting to, unfortunately, see the problems associated with that. Ironically, some of the countries that have never used arsenic as a pesticide control, are having far fewer problems. And it's surprising when we looked at the U.S. data as well as the consumers' report data that countries like Bangladesh and India and Thailand seem to have much less of a problem with the arsenic in their rice.
When we hear about arsenic in groundwater and wells and that sort of thing, and having to have shut down those wells, is that naturally or is that the arsenic that's been introduced into the environment through pesticides and so forth?
It's both.
Okay.
It's both. So we find both in there. And I don't want people to think that, well, gee, if it's organic, it's fine. It's not. But it doesn't appear to be the problem that the inorganic is. But we have both in the wells as well as in the food, both the organic and the inorganic.
And just one more thing. In the Consumer Reports article, they said that different rices tested differently. Did they make a distinction? Are there better rices than others?
There appear to be. Unfortunately, brown rice seems to have a little more than white rice. And that's because with the processing for white rice, we take off the hull, and in the hull is some of the inorganic arsenic. The reason I said unfortunately is because brown rice has a lot more nutrients than white rice. So that's one issue. The basmati rice and some of the more flavorful rices that come from Thailand and India tend to have less than white rices in some of the parts of the United States. Interestingly, the Consumers Report data suggested that Texas, which is the largest producer of rice in the United States, has the highest concentration of the inorganic arsenic. California, and I'm not saying that just to boost California here, but California seems to have less. But we don't have enough data. The government's going to be coming out with more data sometime, quote, soon, and I have no idea what that means, but hopefully within the next year or so, we'll have much more data about rice and where to buy it.
In the meantime, is there anything people can do? I mean, a lot of people eat rice all the time. Should they consider the origin of the rice?
I think so. I think considering the origin is one thing. I think perhaps not having it quite as much as some people do is another. One thing you can do is cook it differently. If you cook it like you cook pasta, that is, cook it in lots of water, then discard the water. You'll be getting rid of a lot of the arsenic. The problem with that is you also get rid of some of the nutrient. But with white rice, frankly, there isn't much nutrient anyway. It's mainly just calories. There are other things you can do. Look for, as I mentioned, products that are grown, for example, in California or basmati or jasmine rices. Those seem to have less. Another thing is to look at the label on prepared foods, because if there's brown rice syrup that's used, and you find that a lot in health food stores, it's in junk food, avoid that because it's got the rice syrup, which is going to have some of the arsenic in it. So I would avoid that as well. Frankly, those foods you should avoid anyway. They just tend to be empty calories. So those are some things that you can do.
I wanted to turn the conversation to something that takes up a lot more space in the supermarket than rice does these days, and that's multivitamins.
Yeah, it sure does.
It's very, very common for people to take multivitamins now.
I was going to say, multivitamins it's a multi-billion dollar industry. And frankly, I know very few people who don't take them, at least in my age group, which is in the after 50 category. As a matter of fact, the wellness letter, and we pride ourselves on evidence-based medicine, we recommend that people over 50 or people who don't have good diets, they should take a multivitamin. But frankly, we have no hard data to support that statement. The thinking behind a multivitamin is the idea that, well, gee, if I'm not getting everything I should from the foods, I can just take this pill and that's going to take care of things. But when we look for good science to support that kind of thinking, it's just not there. Now, that said, a little hope for the multivitamin user is the following. There was a study that was published this summer in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, and it was a placebo-controlled double-blind study, which means it was the gold standard study. And it was it showed that the people who took multivitamins versus the placebo had 13 fewer cancers for 1,000 users over 10 years. Now, that's not a lot, but it was fewer cancers and it was statistically significant. Tucked into that, there are a few caveats, though. One, this was called the doctor study, and it was done on primarily males. It was primarily older males. It was primarily people who are healthier and tend to have more financial resources. So it was not a randomly selected group from the American society. The second thing was that study showed, as I mentioned, that people had fewer cancers, but it didn't show that there were fewer deaths from cancer or, frankly, from anything else. So it wasn't like, oh, this is the study that finally shows that taking a multivitamin is a great idea, because it's not. But it was a little bit encouraging.
What is the purpose? This may be the, painfully obvious answer question, a question with an answer, but what is the purpose of a multivitamin anyway?
Well, I think that's a great question. I mean, the obvious answer is, well, it's, as I said earlier, it's going to supply us with the things we may be missing if we're not eating a healthy diet. frankly, it's pretty hard for most people in the United States not to get a fairly healthy diet if they put a small amount of effort into it. Now, that said, I do recognize, and tragically, there are an awful lot of people who aren't getting a healthy diet because they don't have the financial resources. But for people who do have sufficient money to buy food, it's not hard to get a healthy diet. The second thing is that we've identified things we call vitamins and minerals, and we put them in these pills, and we think that's going to give us everything we need. Frankly, we don't know the combinations of these ingredients, how important those combinations are, the quantities in foods, how important that is. I think it makes so much more sense to get your vitamins through food, healthy foods, as opposed to thinking we're going to get it through a pill.
So are some multivitamins better than others too? You mentioned that people with the financial resources or who lack the financial resources for a healthy diet may benefit more, but they're also multivitamins are not cheap.
No, they're not, but they are and they aren't. They aren't cheap if you get them with all the bells and whistles, all these different things added.
Okay.
There's a lot of marketing that's involved, like multivitamins for seniors, multivitamins for women, multivitamins for men, all these kind of things. That's all marketing, and there's no science behind any of that. Frankly, if you buy a very inexpensive generic vitamin that says USP on it, which means that it's at least been what's in there is what they claim is in there,
mm-hmm.
That's really just a penny or so per pill, and so it is very affordable. It's when you start getting these things, as I mentioned, with the bells and whistles, mm-hmm. that you start adding up things. Speaking of adding up things, it's really important to remember that one of the minerals that's put in multivitamins commonly is iron. And if you're older and if you're a male or if you're an older woman and no longer menstruating, you don't need iron. And as a matter of fact, there's a lot of people who don't handle iron very well in terms of their bodies. They can't get rid of it adequately, or they may absorb too much, and it can be a problem with iron overload. So it makes a lot of sense, unless you're in that category of a menstruating woman, to make sure you buy a multivitamin without added iron.
And that might include those silver versions.
Yeah, exactly. The silver versions, yeah, that's for the silver hair people, right? and sure, yeah, I'd definitely avoid those. you just pay a lot of money for those things, and there's no value to that at all. That the study I mentioned in JAMA, for example, just used a very generic multivitamin. There was nothing special about it at all.
As far as when you take vitamins and different kinds of supplements, your body doesn't necessarily absorb them if you're not also eating a kind of a healthy diet.
Well, some of them aren't absorbed as well as others, depending upon what you're eating. That's right, and depending on what's in your stomach at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it does make a big difference. You know, the reason, coming back to something I said earlier, the reason the Wellness Letter recommends multivitamins for people 50 and over is because there is a lot of good data that shows that older people don't absorb the B vitamins quite as well as we did when we were younger.
From food?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so based upon that, it seemed to make sense to take at least a B complex. So that's what we based the multivitamin recommendation on. But that's frankly all the science we had to make that recommendation.
You wrote in your column this month about the joys of exercise and why we actually do feel better after a good workout. I made sure that I worked out this morning so I could join in the Love Fest with you. But tell us about, it's an interesting approach to the idea of exercise. Good for you. It feels good, too.
Right. Yeah, well, I think everybody's probably exercising for the first 2 weeks of January because they made that resolution. And then by the end of the month, everybody will have stopped again. The problem I've been thinking a lot about what's the problem with exercise? Why don't more people do it? Because there's so much data that shows that it helps us feel better and live longer and live healthier and do more things with our body. And I think the problem is that all those things that doctors tell patients about and people read about are long-term things. It's like, so it adds a few years to the end of my life. Big deal. You know, it's what can you do for me now kind of thinking. Mm-hmm. And frankly, it's hard for human beings to really project out 10, 20, 30 years and what their investment right now is going to mean. So that doesn't seem to be a stimulus for exercise. But I really enjoy exercise, and so I started to think about why I enjoy it. And I enjoy it because it makes me feel better immediately. At the end of the day, I tend to like to go to the gym and exercise, and if the weather's nice, run outside or run on the treadmill in the gym. And I'm sometimes drag myself into the gym exhausted at the end of the day, and by the end of the exercising, I'm invigorated again and ready to go for much of the evening. So it helps me immediately feel a lot better. And there's a lot of data about exercise and mood, and I've even noticed it with myself. I tend to have a more positive outlook after exercising than when I had when I went into the gym. So I think there's some immediate benefits. And if people think about those and start to appreciate those, I think that keeps you going.
And the New York Times exercise columnist Gretchen Reynolds has recommended in his book by the title, you know, the first 20 minutes and maybe just 20 minutes once a day is maybe all it really takes for most people to attain what they're shooting for.
Yeah, if you look at the CDC website on exercise, which is really a good place, it talks about how much exercise you need. And there are a few things in there. One is you don't need to exercise continuously for 20 or 30 minutes. You could do 10 minutes three times a day or twice a day. You don't need to push yourself till you're just exhausted or you're drenching in sweat. You just need to raise your heart rate. So it doesn't have to be hard and burdensome on your body. You should aim for 150 minutes a week, which would be ideal. That would be 30 minutes five times a week. But remember, exercise could be just walking. And, you know, one thing that I had for a while, unfortunately it broke, was a pedometer. And on the UC Berkeley campus, I found that I got an awful lot of steps in during the day. And not taking the elevator was another thing. All that counts for exercise.
And also, I was reading on Facebook today, a lot of people complaining about all the neophytes coming into the gym, you know, how they're packed at the beginning of the year. And one of the people that commented said, well, I get my exercise, biking, yoga, you know, she doesn't think of it as exercise. She's just doing things she enjoys.
Right. It's moving your body. Exactly. Our bodies, we evolved to, as a species, that have great minds, but also bodies that need exercise and actually grow on exercise and actually flourish on exercise. There's a recent paper that was really interesting showing the correlation between brain size and exercise.
Well, Dr. Swartzberg, thanks for joining us today for our first installment of Wellness Wednesday.
Thank you. My pleasure.
It's Dr. John Swartzberg. He's chair of the editorial board for the UC Berkeley Wellness Letter. Thanks for joining us today, and thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.